Welcome, everyone. We are very excited about our presentation for today. My co-chair, Senator Erickson Robes, will join us in a few minutes. She is coming back and from a different state, I believe, and she's on her way from the airport. So we are very excited about the presentation today. We have invited some superintendents, and I'm sorry to announce that the superintendent from Austin Public Schools will not be able to be here because of weather problems, the weather conditions in his area, and he had to cancel. But his PowerPoint presentation is available, and I would like to encourage you to review it. We have today a presentation from Rochester from Superintendent Roman Delman. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Dr. Delman. And we also have a presentation from Higher Ground Academy Charter School. And then we have a presentation from Dr. Joe Nathan from the Humphrey Institute, who will give us an overview of the national perspective. The intent of the hearing today is really to review models that have done excellent work to narrow the achievement gap and who have implemented specific strategies to move their specific districts in that direction. And also, we're very pleased to have Dr. Nathan here, who has done extensive work with other states in the country to bring an overview, a summary of different models that are doing of schools and programs and different districts that are doing great work in this area, and he would like to present the strategies that those models are pursuing. With us today, we have Senator Han. If you would like to introduce yourself, and Jim Carlson.
Thank you. I'm David Han. I represent Eden Prairie and part of Minnetonka, and before coming to the legislature, served on the school board in Eden Prairie, and currently I'm on a charter school board in South Minneapolis that just started this fall, the Hiawatha Leadership Academy. So glad to be here.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Carlson, state senator from Burnsville and Eagan, and I've had some background in education in that I attended a lot of it. But I also served on the board of directors for the Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented in about 10 years ago. So welcome.
Thank you. We would like to ask Dr. Delman to please come and present the efforts that have been pursued by his office and his district with this regard. If you could please introduce yourself for the record, Dr. Delman, and we really appreciate that you're here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Torres-Ray and members of the Senate Education Committee Subcommittee on the Achievement Gap. My name is Dr. Romain Delman, and I am very grateful for the opportunity to be here and share an overview of our effort to closing the opportunity gap in Rochester. I did have a PowerPoint presentation, so I hope you can follow with me as I go through the presentation. The opportunity gap is a term that we use, and it encompasses the entire spectrum of the disparities that exist in our school district. Closing the gap that exists in Rochester in academic performance is for both our minority and white students. And this focus is the cornerstone of our efforts. We do believe, however, that there are gaps in opportunities that greatly impact the overall academic achievement and success of our students. These inequities include access to fine and performing arts activities, as well as sports. And also, we have a suspension gap, an expulsion gap, and many others. Thus, we refer to the opportunity gap as we plan comprehensive and holistic solutions that will lead to excellence in achievement for all of Rochester's students. Now, if you go to the second slide that you have in the packet you have in your hand, in this slide we talk about the fundamental assertion that we subscribe to. It is the title of the presentation that I will give you this afternoon. And it is more than just an affirmation. It is a driver for all of the actions associated with our plan in Rochester. It is our hope that the notion that every student can become proficient is the belief of every student, every teacher, every parent, and every community member in Rochester. This belief is the underpinning of all of our efforts, and data certainly supports this position. Now, what I would like to do is to go ahead and share with you the status of our gap in Rochester. And then I will talk about a framework that we have in place to closing the gap. We are in the process of developing a 5-year plan, which will be completed by the end of March. And I will also close with a summary and talk about what is at stake if we do not take action now. In your slide, you will find slide that have statistics where we have 3,630 students who are part of the gap in Rochester. Rochester's demographics are changing. Our student population is currently 27.4%, a minority. That is a jump from 15.7% just 10 years ago. We're fortunate to be one of the school districts where we are growing in student population. However, the fastest growing subgroup in Rochester are students who are on free and reduced lunch. They are our Hispanic students, our Asian students, and our Black students. Our white student population is declining. In Rochester, 22% of our students are performing below proficiency. And we have a total of 3,630 students who are part of the gap. Our overall student population is 16,330. You will also find that when we look at the results from the last MCA2 test, nearly 60% of our Black students performed below proficiency last year. More than 50% of our Hispanic students performed below proficiency. Overall, more than 25% of our students in Rochester performed below proficient. Now, if we ask ourselves, how do we go about solving this issue? When looking at research that over the past 10 years, there's a body of research by Adamowski and Olszewski where they have 20 common denominators where school districts, urban districts who have been successful when it comes to closing the gap have in place. One of them is that they have a board that does not micromanage. The second is that they all have a theory of change or a theory of action. Now, if we look at the slide called Theory of Change, why do we need a theory of change? Peter Drucker says, every organization is perfectly designed to get the results it gets. We know that our teachers know how to teach because we have students who are performing very well. We also know that our students can learn. Again, we see the results. We have a gap in our system because we do have a system that needs to be tweaked so we can address our gaps. And this is exactly the changes that we are making in Rochester. What we're doing is proposing a new theory of action in Rochester. There are basically five major theories of action. One is a more resource model and effective management model, where you see incremental changes under manage instruction and performance empowerment. We see fundamental change in terms of closing the gap. In Rochester, we are proposing the theory of action that is at the bottom of that slide, which is a manage cross-blended theory of action. And how will we unfold this theory of action? Well, we plan to have a three-tier system where for the year 2008-2009, next school year, we will target seven schools where we have the most number of kids, students, who are part of the opportunity gap. That is tier one. Tier two, and this tier has 1,647 students. Tier two has 1,381 students. And tier three has 235 students. We will revamp our entire curriculum system. We are also working with a firm called the Efficacy Institute, where we have a group of five teachers who are currently getting their efficacy certification. They will work with teachers in the classrooms, as well as parents and community members. We also have a group of parents who are going through the same efficacy training. Their jobs will be to train parents so our parents can become proficient. And they will also train other community members in the evening. We're also exploring possible extended school day, as well as Saturday schools. And we currently have a committee in place where we are looking into possible alternatives for year-round schooling. The umbrella that all of these work will fall under, again, is the fundamental belief that all students can become proficient. We will focus on teaching and learning, revamping our curriculum, access and equity, as well as cultural and diversity, which involves the training that we will provide to our parents, as well as our students and our teachers. Now, let's talk about what is it that we can expect if we do nothing. In your packet is a slide that shows a survey that was conducted in the year 2000 by Ron Ferguson. And this survey was conducted looking at the population of 26 to 30-year-old black and white males that were either worked the prior year from the survey, the week the survey was conducted, or that were either incarcerated. We find that in this, the first slide, you will find that the percentage of 50% of the black male dropouts had worked the prior year, while 26% of black male dropouts were incarcerated during the week of the survey. Again, for black males that graduated from high schools, 66% of them were employed in the year the survey was conducted, while 11% of them were incarcerated. Finally, the odds were best for the black males that were college graduates. This group had the highest employment rate, and only 1% of them were incarcerated during the survey week. As you can see, making sure that our students receive proper education is an economic investment in our state. Invest in education means that we are less likely to have a need to invest in the criminal justice system. Bottom line is this, legislators: education is the number one crime prevention strategy we have in this country. And in summary, I know I brushed through the presentation and I did not have a PowerPoint to walk through, but I hope that the information that I share with you provide you with an overview of the gap in Rochester with, again, our new theory of action that will impact our schools and have an effective and transformational way of making sure that our students are successful. As we move forward, we will constantly seek to engage our entire constituents in the belief, once again, that all of our students can be proficient. We can no longer have our schools to frustrate the aspirations of young people, but rather, we want all of our students to become competitive and successful and compete in a fast-changing, multi-ethnic global economy. By focusing on teaching and learning, deploying programs to address access and equity, and optimizing changing in dynamic of culture and diversity in our community, we plan to bring all students to proficiency in academic and life success. Our students must be prepared to compete globally. The distinction between those who are prepared and those who are not will only get worse, not better. The task at hand requires reflection, vigilance, patience, innovations, as well as determine our limited resources and devise the means to use them in our greatest advantage. In the end, success will depend on our vision, action, not inaction, and the cooperation of our entire community and our ability to integrate the five-year plan and the framework that I shared with you earlier. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dolman. I sincerely apologize for the mistake. We didn't have our equipment ready for your presentation. We made a mistake with our schedule, and we made a reservation for later, and then we moved the time of our committee, and we didn't time this properly, so I apologize for that. And I believe the staff is working on that right now, but obviously it will not be on time for your presentation. But thank you. We had a handout that we were able to follow with your presentation. We would like to welcome Senator Salzman, who has joined the committee.
Thank you very much.
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Senator Kathy Salzman, and I represent the Far East Metro, Woodbury, Stillwater, and North St. Paul. And I had the opportunity to meet with you. Was it last spring, I believe? We had an opportunity. And at that time, I know we talked about the achievement gap, but truly it is an opportunity gap. And I noticed that in your handouts right away.
Correct.
You're right on with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Dolman? Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Dalaman.
Dalaman.
Thank you. I appreciate your being here today. I'm curious to know a little bit more about you talked about a structure and a model, and has this model been employed in other school districts? Which other ones? What has been the results of that? I'm just curious to know what kinds of success others have used with this model. And I guess secondly, I'm curious to know a little bit about what is different about this model with respect to the teaching or the curricular components that you mentioned that as one of the three things you're focusing on, and what is different about that from, say, what you're currently doing in Rochester?
Thank you. There's about 13,500 school districts around the United States. Very few urban districts have been successful when it comes to closing the opportunity gap. And one of the common denominators is that all of them have a theory of action, the ones that are successful at closing the gap. And the research shows that it is not as important as which theory of action you have, but it is more important to have a theory of action that determines how the school district conducts business. For example, under managed instruction, we have a school district like Norfolk, Virginia. Norfolk, Virginia is what is known as a 90-90-90 school district, where 90% of the students are minorities. 90% of the students are on free and reduced lunch, and 90% of the students pass and exceed the Virginia state exam. We have under performance empowerment, Cincinnati, where they implemented that model about 8 years ago, and now they begin to see tremendous success. 2 weeks ago, there was an article in Education Weekly where they talk about Cincinnati and the progress they're making when it comes to closing the opportunity gap. Under balanced blended model, we have New York City Public Schools, which is a system where they have 1.3 million students. This past year, New York City was identified by the Broad Foundation to be the number one district when it comes to showing progress on closing the opportunity gap. And New York City used the balanced blended model. 2 years ago, the Boston City Public Schools used the balanced blended model as well. And 2 years ago, Boston also won the Broad Award for being the district in the nation where they show the most progress around closing the opportunity gap. We are in a different situation in Rochester. We're not where New York or Boston was. Therefore, we are developing our own model. This is a new innovation, and it is very exciting, and the staff are getting around this and really supporting this model. This management cross-blended model is a combination of the balance/blended model compared with effective management. We have a lot of wonderful things in Rochester that have been in place and are working well. We want to continue to honor the past, honor what many put in place that are working, and at the same time, bring new innovation so we can move toward the 21st century by making sure that all of our students are fully prepared for a multi-ethnic global economy.
Thank you.
Senator Saltz.
Follow-up question, please, Madam Chair. Director Dalmond, I recently attended a National Conference of Legislators event, and it was on high school dropouts. And one of the things that other states are doing is a longitudinal data where they track students. And Senator Wieger and I talked about that we're not doing that in Minnesota right now. But if we were to look at something like that, where it's extremely useful, is that as children move from across school districts, but also that it might be something where you could start to red flag events that happen within a child's progress that perhaps we should intervene earlier, where a child maybe isn't, again, qualifying for special ed, but starting to look at what sort of events when they fail a class, what is that going to mean in terms of their future progress. The other thing that you just mentioned was on Boston, and that they've shown incredible advancements, especially in reading scores. And in the early intervention and literacy work group, Senator Olson and I are looking at that. And one of the things that they did was to develop, and we're trying to find the correlation, is that they instituted a literacy exam for teachers to ensure that teachers had skills in the most effective reading strategies. And I know the Reading Center in Rochester works with your school district, and we've been listening to them. Do you have any insight into that? I know that the schools that are involved with your Reading Center have shown incredible progress, but do you have an idea of where, early literacy and more effective strategies could be helpful?
I do support a system where we do not only look at seniors who drop out, but we focus on kids from pre-K all the way. Mm-hmm. And by all the way, I'm referring to adulthood. Right. So I think we certainly need to focus on that. And in terms of dropouts, the National Dropout Prevention Center published a study several years ago on dropouts. And they had 15 different initiatives or recommendations on how to prevent dropout. And there was a conference when we asked them if they had to recommend one of the strategies, which one they would recommend. And the answer was kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Dropout prevention begins in kindergarten. It doesn't start in the 12th grade or in high school when the students already have their mind made up. That they are going to drop out. We currently work with a new organization that is underway in Rochester called First Step. And what we're going to do with First Step is that we're going to assess every student from the age of 3, and we will assess them again at the age of 4, and we'll continue to assess them every year. Part of that assessment from the age of 3 will include recommendations that we will provide, as well as training to the child care providers, including the private babysitters, as well as parents, in how to assist their children. We want to get all of our students ready for kindergarten. We want to get them ready from day one. And we are going to use DIBELS as the assessment that we will use to test our students. And in terms of strategies, recommendations for early literacy, we currently have a committee in place where we are looking at that as well, because part of the assessment that we will conduct will also come with recommendations in how to help students to become successful. And it is very crucial. That was a study in the 60s called 30 Million Word Gap, where it was a longitudinal study that showed that by the time students graduated high school, those that came from poverty had a 30 million word gap compared to those that came from wealth. And so we need to start our students early. We need to train the child care providers. We need to train our parents. One of the major initiative we are going to have next year. We already have a group of parents. They are going through a training with the Efficacy Institute, which is a firm out of Boston. Those parents will become efficacy certified, and we're going to have them working with parents in the afternoon and in the evening and train our parents and helping our parents so they can help with their children at home.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to welcome our co-chair, okay. Senator Erickson Robes. If you would like to introduce yourself, and then Senator Han has a question.
Okay. Well, I'll just pass. I've been here for quite a while, so we'll just go to Senator Han.
Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Dahlman, 3 or 4 years ago, I had a chance to visit a school in the Rochester district, and I apologize, I can't recall the name of the school, but they were the one school in the district that had implemented a core knowledge curriculum, and I just wondered, how's that school doing, and is that still part of what is going on, and what has been their story? They seemed to be very enthused about that at that point and felt it was very useful in their attempt to try to address the achievement issues of poor and minority students.
Thank you, Senator Han. That would be Washington Elementary School. In fact, Washington just won a Blue Ribbon Award out of 8 schools in Minnesota that won this Blue Ribbon Award, 287 schools in the United States. We were one of them. And the core knowledge curriculum is working extremely well for our students at Washington Elementary. In fact, what we're going to do next year is to begin a hybrid core knowledge model in all three of our middle schools, where we will offer core knowledge as the basic curriculum, combine that with pre-AP courses for our middle school students. The focus is on rigor for all of our students.
Any other questions? Dr. Dahlman, I would like to hear your input with respect to a process that we are developing right now. I am in the process of drafting a bill to address this issue, and what I think we have been directed to do is to come up with flexible language that will give you that flexibility to put in a plan in place that is built on efforts that are already being implemented, and also give you somewhat of a framework based on research. And I am working right now with my co-author in the House, Representative Carlos Mariani, and I would like to hear a little bit from you as to what is the right balance with respect to giving you, the person who is in charge of the schools, the flexibility to continue to do the work that you need to do, but also providing the framework. How do you see the balance? Because we know that there are certain things that we need to do, and we know from research that those things work. We talk about teacher quality, early childhood education, certain elements that you are right now implementing involving parents in the process. I would like to hear a little bit of your kind of your input. What is your recommendation with respect to the direction that the state should take?
Well, it begins with the fundamental belief that all students can become proficient, and there should be no excuse around that. And two, we are living in an era where the world is flatter than we think. We are preparing our students not only to compete with students here in Minnesota or Iowa or Wisconsin. Our students will have to compete against students in India and China. And academic rigor is crucial, and it ought to be required for all of our students. Closing the opportunity gap is not the sole responsibility of the school district. On an average, our students spend somewhere around 20% of the time they are awake in schools. Mm-hmm. During the rest of the 80% of the times, they are in the community. They are in other community organizations, at the Y, they are at the library, they are at home and other places. One of the things that we are doing is getting the entire community on board. And we are meeting with all of our different service agencies so all of us can work toward achieving the same goal and have one purpose in mind. The gap is different from Minneapolis or St. Paul or Rochester. And therefore, a legislation that addresses the opportunity gap ought to be a framework that provides leverage where a superintendent or district can then have enough flexibility to address the issues within the context of that community. One good example is that we hire a firm called the Education Development Center, or EDC, and they are in Rochester. They are looking at over 800 pages of data. They interviewed teachers from 15 of our schools. They interviewed students. They had several meetings with our stakeholders and had several parent forums. and they also met with administrators. And what they're doing is taking the literature and what the literature says about the gap and take the Rochester school district and provide feedback to the Rochester Public Schools and put the achievement gap or the opportunity gap for Rochester in a Rochester context. Pre-K is very important. Again, when we have students coming to us with less than others, we need to be able to have the flexibility to give them more, not less. As I mentioned earlier, for some of our students, they will need extended day. Others will need extended week via Saturday school. And other students may need year-round schooling. Again, we are looking at our students based on how they are performing, and we will make those types of decisions, especially in an era where I am looking at a $12.6 million cut next year. It does not help not having the appropriate fundings to make this possible. However, the focus must be an intense focus on teaching and learning. There ought to be a strong focus on pre-K. Major emphasis on community and parent support, bringing community agencies together. And the final piece that I did not mention is accountability. And the accountability ought to start with me down into the classroom. And without the accountability piece, it's not going to happen.
Thank you. If we don't have any more questions for Dr. Dahlman, thank you so much for your presentation. We really appreciate that you are here, and we will continue to be in communication with you as we move forward with this effort. Our next presentation is an overview of national efforts that are being implemented, and Dr. Joe Nathan will give us an overview. It timely came to my office to give me a copy of a report that has been put together to show models at the national level that have been put together in this report that I think all of you have. And I'm very appreciative, Dr. Nathan, that you're here to provide an overview of these specific programs. Before we move with your presentation, I would like to let the audience know that we have today with us 17 Wellston Fellows visiting our capital today, and we are delighted that you are here learning and teaching about civic engagement. Welcome, Pam Costain and Fellows. We look forward to have a conversation with you after our hearing, and we will be here. Thank you for coming. Dr. Nathan, welcome.
Madam Co-Chairs, thank you very much. And members of the legislature, ladies and gentlemen, including special friends from Wellstone Action. I'm here to take you on a tour of the United States, and indeed a bit of a tour around the world, to talk not about problems, of which we know there are many, but about solutions. Some of them require money in addition. Some of them require great creativity and greater collaboration. And so, for example, when Senator Salzman asked a few moments ago about longitudinal assessment, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to talk about something that the legislature might do to gather information in a way that right now is already being done by the University of Minnesota and the Minsky College system. I'm going to echo some of the themes that you just heard from the superintendent, but I'm going to try to describe some things happening around the United States and indeed around the world that are extraordinary, that I think are incredibly promising and build on the rich creativity and bipartisan nature that has happened in this building so much over the last 25 years. And I want to say Senator Torres Ray, that I deeply appreciate the opportunity to be here, and it is so encouraging to see senators from urban, suburban, and rural areas, and yes, I'm going to describe urban, suburban, and rural examples from all over the United States, including this state. But it's so good to see people of both parties and people of different parts of the state sitting down together to talk about some possibilities. I have a series of recommendations, but before I make the recommendations, I want to give you this quick tour. And many of you have a copy of this report, Smaller, Safer, Saner, Successful Schools. It's also available on our website. Our taxes did help pay for it, and I brought about 35 copies with me today, but it is also available free on our website. So let me start with a quick tour on page 7. The first is on page 7 of the report is a picture of a school in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's a high school. It's a high school where when I met the people from that high school 7 years ago, the graduation rate was 42%. This is now a high school that has a graduation rate of 83%. Did they do any single thing? No. They broke the school into two small schools. They removed an administrator who, by and large, most people had agreed was not doing the job that needed to be done. More than $500,000 of Bill and Melinda Gates funds were provided to help the school to move from 42 to 80%. They focused very explicitly on a handful of things. Senator Hamm talked about the core knowledge curriculum. They had an adapted core knowledge curriculum that focused on doing a handful of things really well. The superintendent from Rochester, who you just heard, talked about the value of community partnerships. They brought in, at no cost to taxpayers, a social service agency that shared space because, as the superintendent noted, and all of us know, it's common sense. Youngsters, in some cases, and this is true in rural, urban, and suburban areas as well as urban, youngsters bring sometimes challenges with them. So they had a social service agency that came to the school that was provided space at no cost to the taxpayers. And this social service agency did extensive work with the school. Indeed, you will see many, many examples, both of district and charter public schools, of this kind of thing in this document. You'll see an example in this document of a suburban school in Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan, that shares space with the Minnesota Zoo. And again, at no additional cost to taxpayers, is able to open up many opportunities for youngsters, including youngsters who've not done particularly well in a traditional school system because they're sharing space with the Minnesota Zoo. And just taking a 10-minute walk, very healthy walk, except not today in 20 below wind chill, but a very healthy walk allows these kids to have access to different kinds of opportunities that they would not if the school were sitting off by itself. All right, so Withrow is here, and it went from 42% graduation rate to 83%. Not any one thing, and I'll say more about what it did. If you then turn to page 65, you'll see a few pictures of Withrow. You'll see that sometimes people talk about how we have to give up the arts in order to get to academics. And in virtually every one of the schools that I'm going to talk about today, that was the reverse of what happened. Indeed, that the arts, music, drama, painting, sculpture, singing, a mariachi band, were seen as absolutely central to the improvement of academic achievement because it helped to give the youngsters pride, it helped to give the youngsters a feeling of cohesion, and frankly, because the arts touch us in ways that other things don't necessarily do. So Withrow University is a shining example. As some of you know, I recently wrote about this for a national publication called Education Week. CNN called, and CNN in the last 10 days has now devoted two programs to what's happened in Cincinnati because it's not just in this school. Indeed, the entire district has gone overall from 51% high school graduation rate to 79% graduation rate in 7 years. It hasn't been any one thing. And as the Star Tribune column notes that's in your packet, it was a series of things. It was having a vision. It was getting a handful of explicit, measurable goals. It was the terrific collaboration and encouragement from the Cincinnati Federation of Teachers, which took a leading role in saying to its members, this is a very important and valid thing for us to do. It was the availability of staff development, focused staff development. They didn't try to do staff development on 10 or 20 things. They did staff development on three things. literacy, numeracy, and effective ways to work with teenagers. So Withrow represents a dramatic improvement in an urban public school system, that has many challenges. When we began working with Cincinnati, about 45% of the kids were low income. Today, 66% of the kids are low income. So I'm going to say that again. This is a district that's gone from 51% graduation rate to 79% graduation rate at a time when they've gone from 44% low income to 66% low income. It is a school district that's 70% African American, about 21% Caucasian or European American, about 1.5% Hispanic. It is possible to make dramatic improvements in a relatively short time using a certain core combination of things. The next of three or four examples that I want to offer to you is on the very next page, after Withrow, Yes Prep. This is a charter public school in Houston, Texas, which uses some of the core knowledge ideas, which uses youth community service, as, by the way, was done extensively in Cincinnati. I will never forget watching some of the graduates of several of the high schools in very tough and difficult sections of town brought back by the high school to talk with kids who were challenged and not able and having lots of difficulty passing graduation tests, which, by the way, in the state over the last 7 years have gotten more difficult. So Cincinnati's faced increasing percentage of kids who are low income, increasing percentage of kids who have, a statewide test that's gotten more difficult, and the graduation rate has gone up dramatically. What happened in Cincinnati was that, among other things, and I forgot to mention this, they had a very strong component of youth community service. Something, of course, that Senator Wellstone was a deep and vigorous and constant advocate of. Because young people need to see themselves differently, and there is no amount of money that can be spent if young people still think they're going to fail. So over and over again, young people were mobilized to talk with their younger brothers and sisters and other children who are somewhat younger to say, you can do it, and to give specific examples. And there were partnerships galore, a partnership in Cincinnati, a partnership at Yes Prep, with, for example, a local phone company that said to the people at one particular high school in Cincinnati, if you maintain a B average, then we will give you a cell phone. And if you keep the B average, you keep the cell phone. They also brought in hundreds of people from the community, from their own company, to tutor kids. But they also had youngsters who had just graduated coming in to talk. It was not any single thing. Yes Prep is an extraordinary charter public school, and you will not hear me say all the wisdom is in district schools or all the wisdom is in charter schools or all the wisdom is in private parochial schools, because we have fabulous examples of each. And one of the things that I'm going to urge you to consider is to recognize what all of us know, which we do have fabulous examples of each kind of school. And so Minnesota might lead the nation yet again in saying, let's learn explicitly from the best of these schools all over the nation. So at Yes Prep, they're not satisfied with kids who graduate. A graduation requirement at Yes Prep is that each youngster has to apply to four different schools that are higher education, post-secondary. That's a graduation requirement. You don't get out of there. Something we've been encouraging a lot of the schools with which we work, because high school graduation is not enough. Not everybody has to go to college. Not everybody has to go to four-year college or universities. One of the most exciting programs I've seen in many years is in Anoka Tech, where the kids are, high school kids are taking college courses right now in plumbing and carpentry. We have examples of this throughout greater Minnesota. We've seen some of this throughout the state. But this is great for some kids who are bored stiff, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to Shakespeare, but are bored stiff with Shakespeare. But these are youngsters right during their college years who are having a chance to build a house or to repair cars and see the value of math and reading and writing. So again, money can be spent, but unless there's a change in the motivation of the youngster, unless the youngster sees her himself doing something very exciting, you can spend a lot of money and not get much of a result. So Yes Prep is a terrific example of a charter public school that's actually being replicated. And you can see the statistic, 78% of Yes alumni have graduated or are still enrolled in a four-year college or university, where we've asked Yes Prep to come to the Twin Cities to make a presentation later this year. Some of their graduates have now come back and are teaching in this school. Just a couple of other examples in this booklet, and then I want to get to a few other statistics that I think are important. I mentioned that I was going to cite a suburban example, and if you turn to page 60, you'll see the School for Environmental Studies in Apple Valley, a terrific example of a district public school created by a group of parents and teachers in collaboration with the zoo. This school, even though it is a fraction of the size of the large district schools, costs no more money per pupil. It was built for the same per pupil dollars. And I would encourage you, if you're interested in outstanding suburban schools such as this one, which has won a number of awards from throughout the nation, and it's had visitors from not only from throughout the nation but throughout the world, to check out the School for Environmental Studies. I could give many other examples in here, but I won't. I just want to ask you to take a look at two last things. One is a chart on page 12. As Senator Torres Reyes knows, and as Senator Erickson Ropes knows, I've been an advocate for strong, not just for small, but for strong small schools for a number of years. Indeed, our center co-hosted in the mid-1980s a series of seminars in Rochester, in Bemidji, in the Twin Cities, and one other in Morris, to talk about the research about small schools. But small is not enough, although I'll talk about some research that's been done recently about small schools in Minnesota and how they do on a statewide assessment of readiness for college. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But I do want to call your attention to this report put out by the University of Washington, and we excerpted a part of it here, comparing the impact of small, these are urban district schools, and look at the differences in theft, between youngsters who in schools, these are reports by teachers, by the way, reports for teachers in smaller schools and larger schools. We're talking about apples and apples here. We're talking about secondary schools that are small compared to secondary schools that are large. We're talking about elementary schools that are small compared to elementary schools that are large. And you can see the differences in teacher reports of all kinds of negative behavior. And you can see pretty dramatically that smaller schools, on average, according to teacher reports from throughout the nation, are doing better. I want to ask you to take one last look at this booklet, because one of the things that I want to share with you, and again, I appreciate the opportunity to do so, is ideas not only from the United States but from around the world. And on page 21, you'll see something that I would hope that we could replicate throughout the state. You'll see on the bottom of page 21 a three-story building. The second and the third story is a senior citizen apartments and equivalent of condos, but for moderate-income senior citizens. And the first floor is an elementary school. And congregate dining is provided in the lunchroom on the first floor. And many of the seniors love being in this facility because they can volunteer without going out into the weather, which isn't as nasty as we get it here, but they can get pretty damp and wet in the Netherlands. But it's very easy to go back and forth. And the seniors, there are waiting lists for these kinds of programs. They're putting up a number of these in the Netherlands. We're going to have an increasing percentage of people my age and older, the baby boom, who are going to be looking for housing. I don't have to tell you about all the statistics you're hearing about health care and so on and so forth. Well, a number of the places that we're talking about, and by the way, there is also a medical facility in this that serves the seniors and serves the elementary kids. We have examples in this document of district and charter schools that have social service agencies, that have health care facilities, that have higher education, all in the same building. So what I want to say to you is that can money be useful? Absolutely. But money needs to be spent in really skillful and thoughtful ways, and it is the legislature that can provide incentives. It is the legislature that can say to community organizations, to social service agencies, to foundations, we'll provide incentives. About 15 years ago, in this room, a group of high school kids from Greater Minnesota testified about the value of school-based entrepreneurship. And this Senate Education Committee decided, in taking the lead, that it was going to challenge the Minnesota Rural Initiative Funds and to say, if you put up some money to help promote school-based entrepreneurship, we'll put up some money. And that's absolutely what happened. And public dollars were doubled because of the partnership between the state legislature and the initiative funds. So my last points are a summary on this document, and copies are available over here. I have only a few things for you to consider. First, one of the keys to the progress in Cincinnati, one of the keys to what I've seen throughout the country, and I've been an inner-city public school teacher and administrator, been a PTA president at our children's elementary school in St. Paul. My wife has been a public school special ed teacher in St. Paul for the last quarter century. Our older daughter has been for the last 4 years a public school math teacher in the public school here in St. Paul. What I've seen all over the country in our work, whether it's in rural, urban, or suburban areas, the gentleman here from the Blandon Foundation earlier, we were talking about our work with the Blandon Foundation throughout greater Minnesota, is that if people can concentrate on three or four things, that there will be significantly more progress. Secondly, and you've heard this before, I think it's just absolutely critical that this legislature make it a priority to fund high-quality early child education for certain groups of kids. And if you look on the second page, you'll see an editorial from the Star Tribune citing some research that some Humphrey Institute students had done in a capstone, a project, by the way, where Humphrey Institute students do research for free for people in Minnesota, and we would love to work with you. We did, by the way, I believe, Senator Torres Ray, you have a Humphrey Institute student that's serving as an intern with you. And we've earlier, a couple of years ago, did some research on virtual schooling that the then chairperson of the Senate Education Committee did. So we have graduate students eager to do research, people such as yourselves, for free as a part of their educational experience. In any case, in this particular thing, the students looked very carefully at the research on early childhood education, and they concluded, and I think with considerable justification, that not all early childhood programs are equally effective. And the program, for example, that operates 2 hours a week is probably not going to be as effective as a program that operates all year or most of the year. So the second recommendation is to make high-quality early childhood education a high priority. The third is to create a venture capital fund. This would be the first in the country. There is no state that currently recognizes what I think all of us would acknowledge, which is that there's some outstanding district and some outstanding charter schools. Senator Hamm talked about core knowledge, for example. Senator Torres Ray and I have talked about some outstanding schools throughout the United States, and you've invited some of them to come to this committee to testify. We need to do a much better job of replicating successful schools, and it seems to me that the legislature could challenge some of the leading foundations in this state to say, we're willing to put up some money. If you're willing to put up some money, let's get more replication of the outstanding programs going on. Throughout this document are examples of co-location of social service agencies and schools and other organizations sharing space. I gave some examples of this. There are many more around here. When I worked for the National Governors Association, former Secretary of Education Richard Riley was the governor of South Carolina, and he talked about how he brought together the social service agency and the healthcare departments and the education department in South Carolina and said, you're going to get a 0% increase next year in my budget unless I see programs where you're collaborating. I want to see all kinds of examples, and we will provide incentives for you. That is to say, if you do more of the kind of thing that I think makes sense in terms of providing better services, we will increase your budget, and if you don't, we won't. The legislature is not the legislature has, of course, many different committees. And one of the things that I'm hoping that you will do more of is the kind of thing where the education committee talks to the housing committee, talks to the medical committee, and says, not only, as the superintendent here said, how can we work together at the local level, but how can different legislative committees work together to provide incentives for different organizations that receive public funds to work together. One program that again, is not happening anywhere in the United States would be a program that helps parents of teenagers to do a better job. And Senator Torres Ray and I talked about this idea last year, and I realize that you face budget challenges, so I'm not just talking about immediately, but it is extremely difficult to be a parent of teenagers these days. And we have a nationally renowned program called Early Childhood Family Education. Graduate students at the Humphrey Institute did some research on something like this. Once again, no other state has a kind of program that might be envisioned here where we have public-private partnerships to help parents learn how to be more effective parents of teenagers. There are several other suggestions. I just want to end with one. We do not need to have any more testing in this state. We have plenty of tests. However, the legislature has currently requested and already receives every couple of years a report about the percentage of kids who are fully prepared for college. And if you turn to the fourth item in this little packet, you'll see it's called Getting Prepared, State Level Summary, High School Summary. But if we are serious about closing the achievement gap, we can't be satisfied with high school graduation. We want kids to be fully prepared for college. The mayor of St. Paul has pulled together college and university presidents along with school district, the superintendent, and charter school representatives in this town to talk about ways of collaboration. And one of the things that we're talking about is that this report needs to come out every year. We've done an analysis of this report. As you can see, the report was last published in 2005, and will be presented again next month. But I'd like to urge that this be done every year. As you can see, the report says 49% of the kids in Minnesota enter a public college or university, and 36% of those kids have to take a remedial course. And I want to tell you that the high schools that are doing the very best are high schools in greater Minnesota on this report. And we've talked about Rushford Peterson, for example, talked about Winona, which are in your district, Senator. Those schools have some of the very best records in the state. Smaller schools, 45 of the 50 that are doing the very best in this report are small schools. And we have a whole report about that if you're particularly interested. My point here is that we don't need to spend any more money on testing. You could say to the University of Minnesota and say to the Minsky College system, look, you are currently doing this every 3 or 4 years. We'd like to see it done every year. So my central point to you is that creativity, energy, good ideas are in ample supply in this country. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to some of the ways that we might build on those, share those, use those. And unquestionably, it's not simply a matter of what might happen. We have clear evidence from all over the nation that we can make a dramatic positive impact on the lives of all kinds of kids. Money is an ingredient, but so is creativity, competence, and focus. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for this excellent presentation. Just briefly, I want to look at your last bullet point on the University of Minnesota and Minsky publishing a report on the students who need remedial education. This is not a popular topic, but Senator Olson and I will go back to our committee is looking at teacher preparedness and staff development. And I think that this is certainly a valid request, but this issue takes all the stakeholders. And I guess I would also then like to suggest that we look at teachers coming out of our teacher colleges and how many of them are truly prepared to walk into the classroom the first day. And when we hear about school districts spending millions of dollars to send brand new graduates to workshops before they ever walk in the classroom, that may also be remedial education. So when you look at the Kipp Academy in Bronx, New York, I've also heard, and I don't have statistics on this, but that many of the teachers who are starting these academies are coming through alternative teacher programs, such as Teach for America, where, you know, some may say that we're taking some of our best college graduates who are not education majors, send them off to what they're calling boot camps, and while they're teaching in some of these very urban and struggling areas, also go to graduate school. And they find such success that they go on to take this. So where in all this is maybe, and this is a very controversial topic, but where is higher education in all this? Because I know Dr. Stuart Yeh at the U of M just published a study that talked about what sorts of initiatives are most effective in addressing the achievement gap, and there's many different suggestions. And one of his was progressive monitoring, more frequent teacher, you know, testing that teachers like to sort of drive instruction. And yet, I'm not sure that that strategy is being incorporated into our teacher preparedness program. So how can we engage higher ed? Because there, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, you know, Dr. Nathan, but that's an issue that is really touchy. But I think that that's something, too, that is part of this.
Madam Chair and Senator, completely agree. And, in fact, I mentioned briefly a few minutes ago that the mayor of St. Paul had convened a group of people, including college presidents and the superintendent and people from the charter world, and we were having a similar kind of discussion, and the assistant superintendent of St. Paul Schools made precisely the same point that you've made. We did a report several years ago saying that there needed to be much closer communication between the high school, between the K through 12 world and the post-secondary world. And there is now a collaborative effort going on at the University of Minnesota to talk about this. Kent Pakel, as you may know, is coordinating this. And I, in fact, made this precisely this point a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to come back to this issue and have a conversation about it. But I think we need to do more than have a conversation. But if you're interested, I'll make sure that you're invited when we have the conversation, because I know of your work with the local school system. So if you're interested, in fact, you know, if the committee is interested, we can let you know when that's going to take place. One other point. There are some schools that are doing a fabulous job with kids, as noted. About 8 years ago, the legislature agreed to allow outstanding schools, K through 12, outstanding in terms of high overall achievement or outstanding in terms of significant improvements in academic achievement, to have colleges of education based in their building, taught by their teachers. And I actually helped write that piece of legislation. There was an appropriation of less than $150,000 to get it up and running, and Governor Ventura vetoed it. But I continue to believe, and I speak only for myself today, and I'm not an official representative of the Humphrey Institute or the University of Minnesota, but I continue to believe that we ought to offer high-quality teacher training programs based in some of our finest elementary, middle, and high schools in rural, urban, and suburban areas. And, in fact, the framework to do that has already been adopted by the Minnesota legislature. So I think that that's not the total answer, but since I have been in public education since 1970, this issue has been discussed, and I think it's time to try a new model. And I'm not saying that there can't be improvements in the existing model, but I think it's time to try a new model of basing at least some of the teacher training programs in our best urban, suburban, and rural schools in this state.
Could the Madam Chair just follow? I think that it's very encouraging, and that was some of what came out of our most recent hearing in our work group, was having some discussion. And my only disappointment is that when we have these discussions, I don't think any of us want a finger point at all, and that's not the intent. The intent of these discussions is to talk about a very serious issue, and what is disappointing is that we don't see this as opportunities for all stakeholders to say, I learned something today. What can I do? How can my agency, how can my organization help solve this problem, instead of how can I protect my turf? And children are not going to be well served, so I would love to be a part of that group, and so I will speak for Senator Olson. I'm sure she would like to join me.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Nathan, for being here today. I appreciate you bringing up Rushford, Peterson, and Winona. I'll just take it a moment here to plug my community, because if you hadn't done that, I have a little star in your thing here to draw people's attention to page 12, where, in fact, you were talking about a study in Minnesota high schools during the 2000-2003 time period, and you were talking about those rural schools performing very high in terms of their graduates going on to college and needing the least number or least amount of remedial work. And actually, Winona Senior High School was the number one during that time, and I was happy to say I was on the school board at the time, so we were really pleased with that. I've been a big advocate of community service learning for a long time. And, in fact, again, back to the days when I was on the school board, I really thought that we needed to make that a requirement. There's just a lot to be learned beyond simple academics. It increases students' awareness of the fact that they're a citizen in a larger world. And there's so much to be done, and benefiting not only the student but the surrounding family, classroom, and community in terms of community service, I absolutely agree with you, and I wish there was a way that we as a legislature could get to that point, but it seems like we have all these great ideas, and then there's not the commensurate funding that goes along with the ability to roll that out or implement it. And certainly the message we've gotten from the local school districts is, if you're going to make new mandates or expectations for us, make sure it's funded there. So that's one of the points of tension that always face us. I was interested in hearing from you. We've heard from you pretty much similar features of what makes an excellent school, and you're talking about a solid pre-K high-quality experience for students and high-quality teachers and some of the collaborative exercises and features going on. I've been a fan of small class sizes and small school environments for a long time. How much of your research and what you've seen as successful around the country is setting on the foundation of size? We've heard a lot of other things that impact student achievement and impact success and all these other features you've talked about, but how important is the size piece?
Madam Chair and Madam Co-Chair, we cite a good deal of evidence in this report that, in the first half of it, that there is a huge advantage for urban, suburban, and rural kids in small schools. We cite example after example of apples and apples comparisons. Urban kids in small schools versus urban kids in large schools. Rural kids in small schools versus rural kids in large schools. Suburban kids in small schools versus suburban kids in large schools. And I can give you particular references if you want. Small is a huge advantage. Smaller schools, as we try to say in this report, whether it's rural, urban, or suburban, are safer. There is a lower rate of vandalism. There's a lower rate of drug use, and so on and so on and so on. There's a higher graduation rate. However, we have literally hundreds of large buildings in this state, so we can't simply bulldoze them. So we have worked with some school districts to try to create small schools within large buildings, but we have many other facilities around the state, which is why I'm a big fan of the self-governed school idea. I know that Minneapolis is talking about trying to expand that, and I think that would be great. I'd love to see opportunities for rural communities and suburban communities to create small schools within large buildings, as well as different kinds of schools. I mean, so small, I think, is a very valuable but not sufficient condition. And as we say in here, you know, there are examples of small schools that are not doing a very good job. But it, on balance, overall, the evidence, let me just quote one major federal summary that was done during the Clinton administration. And by the way, this doesn't seem to be a Democratic or Republican or liberal or conservative argument. And this is a huge study that was done that concluded, and this is on page 11, right toward the top, a research study of studies commissioned by the U.S. Department of Education, the value of small schools and increasing graduation rates, satisfaction and improving behavior has been, quote, confirmed with a clarity and level of confidence rare in the annals of educational research. It's not enough, but it's a very important thing, and it's true in suburban areas, by the way, as well as urban.
Senator,
thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Nathan. And I realize that's just one singular feature we're talking about here, so not to exclude everything else. But I absolutely agree, and I think the reason is because when you're small, you have an opportunity to form relationships. And there's a culture that is built in a small school that sometimes is lacking a larger school. And, you know, I see it in our rural schools that, you know, kids would never drop out because of peer pressure, or they'd never drop out because of the whole family community bond that goes on there. That's just not what's expected from those kids. So I think it's really valuable. There's a huge tension in the public school system, though, when we are underfunding school districts, and they need to look at consolidation as a way to manage their money. And, you know, when you have all the kids in one building or you take several small ones and put them together, you know, that's it seems like a push to consolidate because of finances. And I'm wondering if maybe hearing from some of the other folks on the committee that, you know, if we can look at what you're talking about, Dr. Nathan, in that we could have an integrated school building. We looked at that many years ago and just never got there in the Winona area. But if we could have other nonprofits, if you have these small neighborhood schools that are just dwindling in population, and there's incredible pressure to close the neighborhood schools, if we could bring in appropriate nonprofits to rent, and there's all sorts of incredible, you know, hurdles to jump through in terms of the state and state departments and who you can rent to and how you handle that whole thing or lease. But that's a way to keep some of these schools open. And I'm a big fan also of integrating social groups like the elderly into buildings. So I think that's something we should really try to look at making possible through some of our bureaucracy that exists right now, that small schools are able to stay open and running because we have this intense pressure on them to close when they get too small. And at the same time, in Winona, we had at one school that it was a neighborhood school dwindling and got down to 50 students, and there was incredible pressure on the school board to close that school and bring those kids into other schools. And right over here, we had a charter school that was opening up with 50 students. And they were saying, small schools are great, you know, the whole rah-rah thing for small class sizes and small classrooms, and sometimes teachers teaching two or three grades in the same classroom, and people were waving flags over here. And over here, there was this pressure to close the same school. So I think we have a lot of discussion to do about the messages we're sending. We're sending two different messages out. One seems to be it's okay this way, and that way it's not okay. So what would you have to say in terms of that tension? I'm sure you know that exists here within the school system. What recommendations could we get from you in terms of supporting a small school environment and some of the roadblocks that you've seen in the system that prevent that?
Madam Chair, I want to, you know, I know Bill Wilson is here, and I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to hear from him as well, because he's a very gifted and bright man whose his school has done some important work. Just a brief comment about this. First, and most important probably, we'd be the Center for School Change would be delighted to work with you. There are fabulous national resources about how to have social service agents or other organizations sharing. We've been doing some research with certain corporations like Carlson Company and Cargill and other large – and Target, other national corporations. And one of the things that we hear over and over again from, for example, Marilyn Carlson Nelson, the CEO, current CEO of – or this current just retired CEO of Cargill is you get what you fund. You get what you reward. In public education, going back to Senator Salzman's comment, we have rewarded people taking more degrees, getting more classes and earning more degrees. And that can be helpful, but that's part of the way you earn more money. Well, if we had funding formulas in this state that encouraged collaboration, we'd have more collaboration between social service agencies and schools and higher education. If the legislature said to the University of Minnesota and the – I'm speaking only for myself now, obviously. I'm getting into very – speaking only for myself, I believe that we would have more programs in this state like the program Arizona Equine Science School, which is a district charter public school on the campus of a community college. I know that Pam Costain, as chairperson of the of the Minneapolis schools, was a big fan of promoting greater collaborations between social service agencies and schools, between colleges and universities. We could have more of this, and you know, it is about incentives. Look what happened in 1985 when the legislature said, we're going to allow high school kids to go to colleges and universities with the dollars following the kids. Almost immediately, with no additional funding, we had new courses crop up in high schools, college in the schools, and then the legislature provided incentives to have more international baccalaureate and advanced placement courses. I mean, when you provide incentives, people respond. The high schools responded. I think it's time to provide some incentives, Senator Salzman, to the colleges and universities to say, if this, then this. And again, I'm speaking only for myself here. I'm not representing the University of Minnesota. But the bottom line is I'd be delighted to work with you. One last point about this. There's sometimes the notion that smaller schools are less expensive. And there's some very interesting studies which we cite that show that if the question is in terms of graduation rates, smaller schools have higher graduation rates. And in New York City, among other places, they found that if you looked at graduation rates, smaller schools were less expensive. And there are examples that we cite in here of consolidations in rural parts of the United States where consolidations ended up costing more money because of increased transportation costs, because you had to buy new uniforms, and so on and so on. So consolidation can be a valuable approach. But again, a school board member, Costain, has said it's time to talk about Minneapolis sharing space with its buildings with charters. The KIPP building in here is sharing space with the district school. There are collaborations if people of goodwill are willing to do so and if the key organizations such as the legislature are willing to provide incentives.
Any more comments? Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Nathan, thank you for your presentation. You are an asset to our state, and I certainly appreciate all the work you've done. And it is you and your colleagues and your organization, I think, have done a real service to our state. Just a question. I think, and I've been persuaded personally, that there are virtues to smaller schools, and I think what you're pointing out is evidence of that. Can you comment about smaller class sizes and what the opportunities may exist for that? We hear a lot of talk about that. Is that part of the thing we need to focus more on? I know we've had over the years a trend to try to do more to achieve smaller class sizes, and we have done that, but what's the research or what's your take on that as a part of this?
Well, I could spend the next hour and won't citing research on both sides of that question. Does our daughter currently teaches a class of 41 at Johnson High School, which is about 10 minutes east of here, and would she be able to accomplish more if she taught a class of 15 or 16? Absolutely. The difference between 41 and 39 is not very much in terms of what you can do. And one of the reasons going back to Senator Erickson Rope's question that I think is really important is I think we have to rethink the amount of money that we're putting into heat and light and security, which is why I'm a big fan of having more shared facilities. Because if we are spending less on heat and light and security and other building issues, we have more money to do certain kinds of things like have significantly lower classes. Many of the schools that are represented here have found different ways to dramatically reduce class size, so it's 15 or 17, not 38 or 40. So if my reading of the research is that if we're talking about a class of 15 to 17, that's one thing. If we're going from 17 to 15 or going from 38 to 15, but under the existing circumstances, it's incredibly expensive. So the legislature's tried to do some things over the years. Governor Ventura promoted it, for example, and others have. But I think that it can happen in conjunction with other ways of rethinking, like, for example, the senior citizens high-rise in the elementary school and so on, to rethink how we spend money and to spend money more efficiently.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Nathan. We really appreciate it, and we will continue to be in touch with you.
Madam Chair.
As we proceed. Oh,
Madam Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make one comment. I must say something about the School of Environmental Studies, being that we have a school board member here from District 196 who has worked on that school. Also, that school district is a very successful school district, being the fourth largest in the state here. But one of the things that, and I'm going to try to get a question in here somewhere, but one of the things that does bother me is this notion of the remedial coursework. When we describe it as remedial. That sounds like a negative. That sounds like a very big negative. It sounds like somebody failed a class in college and had to take something over again. And my sense to this is that it is not a failure of a class. What it is it's a failure to take the prerequisite. These are students that were not college-bound in high school and were not getting the correct advice as to the curriculum path they should be taking. So they came out of school to go to a college, wound up going to perhaps a two-year school first to get some of their prerequisites. And those are classified as remedial. And I have a problem with that in that we in Minnesota have the worst student-to-counselor ratio in the United States. And I think that's something that that ought to be looked at to maybe get rid of that real big problem in remedial classes or prerequisite classes. Do you have a sense as to what that might take for us to get a greater connection between guidance counseling in schools and this getting this number down? Now, and I also have a, you know, the legend is that colleges are fine with this because this is income for them. These are easy students to teach. But do we have some numbers as to the students that require prerequisites and relating that to how many dropouts there are? And also what it would take to get this number down if we had better relationships in the schools?
Madam Chairs and Senator, each of you have asked really important questions, and I'm struggling with how to say something concisely that's constructive and useful. Let's see. I completely agree with you, Senator, that going back to something that Senator Salzman said, that it isn't going to help us to point fingers. In Cincinnati, they didn't point fingers. They said, we're going to have to do some things. You're going to have to do some things. It doesn't help. And I don't mean to be disparaging by saying these are remedial courses, but the reality is that it's costing taxpayers in the state more than $10 million a year for all of the kids who are taking these courses. And I completely – and plus, it's costing the families tuition, and that's money that could be better spent. And I completely agree with you that better counseling would be helpful. One of the things that Cincinnati did was to have a number of ninth grade programs in the summer before kids enter the ninth grade on college campuses. And by the way, those colleges provided space for free for high school programs on their campuses. And we're trying to promote some of that in the Twin Cities as well. And it would help if the legislature would say to the University of Minnesota and some other folks, you know, we see that you have some summer programs for kids. We'd love to see more of that. In any case, better counseling is unquestionably part of the issue. Some of the schools that are in here, like Minnesota New Country in Henderson, Minnesota, have as part of their job description for each faculty member, they are an advisor part-time. And in some of the district schools with which we've worked, in Boston, the pilot schools, which are district public schools, Fenway Middle College, every adult in the building who's a teacher also spends part of her or his time as an advisor. I worked at a K-12 school that was started in 1971 in this city, where every teacher also spent part of her or his time as an advisor. And then the counselor really worked on the very difficult problems. But that school, like several others here, required every youngster to apply to a college or university. So part of the idea from the time you walked in was you're going to have to work on this issue. It's not just a matter of taking how many English or math courses. And by the way, Senator, that course also required and still requires community service for graduation. But going back to your point, last sentence on this, we absolutely have to do a better job of communicating with youngsters in the 8th or the 9th grade about A, there are exciting possibilities for all of you in some form of post-secondary education. And it's not just the academic four-year programs. There are some kids who are very oriented toward those, others who really know about other kinds of things. But we have many youngsters going to some of our programs who do not have good information in the ninth grade. And part of it is counseling. Part of it is redesigning the way we organize learning, teaching, and schooling in junior and senior high schools.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This concludes our work as a committee.
Bill's here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was under the understanding. Okay.
I apologize. I didn't communicate that way.
Yes. I was under the understanding that Mr. Wilson was not here. I am sorry. Please. I was told, Mr. Wilson, that you didn't make it because of the weather situation. But please join us. Thank you for being here. I guess we had a because we were trying to put all of these meetings together and our retreats and every thing in our schedule has been so complicated. I apologize. So I was just given a message that you were not able to be here. So I'm very happy to see you and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
I mean, first of all, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm the director of Higher Ground Academy Charter School, located here in St. Paul. Does the committee have a time table it's working with?
Oh, yes.
We have 20 minutes.
Yeah, we have about 20 minutes.
About 20 minutes. That'll be perfect, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will abbreviate some of my remarks, considering that. Briefly, Higher Ground Academy is, as I said, a charter school. It's a K-12 charter school. We initiated the school as a high school, charter for high school, 9 through 12. We decided after meeting with parents who were asking for a more comprehensive school, a school that would serve their elementary students, middle school children. And we set off starting the school for a whole year so that we could reflect the interests of the community that we were serving. and we opened in 1998. The tenet of our high school is that all children can learn, that children learn all the time, their experience teaches immediately, and that expectations are built on experience. So we set high expectations for our students. We don't have a very complicated curriculum. It's very rigorous and concise. The students follow a very set curriculum that's data-driven. All students who enter our school are assessed for their math and language arts skills. Based on the data, students are placed in a grade level that links up with their academic achievement at that time. Our idea is to increase each student's academic achievement by a grade level and a half each year, recognizing that many students are operating below grade level. For example, if a student transfers into our school, eighth grade and after, and we assess. Typically, we find those students are three or four grade levels behind. This is shocking. It's unfortunate. But I think it contributes a lot to the gap, achievement gap that we're seeing. It's the lack of education early on that compounds itself over time. But with students such as those, we place them in programs that we'll make that up over time. The demographics of our schools, we're a small school. We're 500 students. We intend to stay small. We want to be the best small school around. We reached our 500 students this year. Over 90% of the students attending our school qualify for free and reduced lunch. 72% of those students are East African students. 13% are Oromo students from the area of Ethiopia. And the remaining 15% are African American. Just quickly on those statistics, we feel that the fact that the students receive from low-income families have absolutely nothing to do with their ability or the propensity for learning. We think that's an exposure issue. that can be overcome with education. Education has to be the means by which people can achieve great things. So the fact that they're from low-income families, we said they might be born in poverty, but poverty is not born in them. And so through exposure, they can lift out of that. The fact that they're predominantly new immigrant students in no way is a barrier to their learning. It certainly puts them on a different track when things start, but through a rigorous and concise approach to education, those two are overcome. We're a very diverse school. We have a staff of about 69 employees. There are three administrators. We keep the administrative staff small. 25 of those 69 are teachers. They're all licensed in Minnesota. There's 41 support staff members, including teacher aides, transportation, clerical, behavior counselors, and recreation staff. And that workforce is diverse. 38% are African American, 40% are African, and 22% are Caucasian. Now, having said all that about our school, we do face some major challenges. The first, and again, I dare not attempt to speak for all schools. I'm only speaking for this one small school. Our challenges are a couple I'd like to focus on. One is that the time to educate students sufficiently to meet proficiency standards in math and English skills. I set that out as a challenge because with new immigrant students, they are expected, according to NCLB regulations, to take the MCA the second year. Implicit in that situation is that they'd be at grade level in 1 year. Now, that simply does not add up. We work very, very hard to educate the students, but honestly, it's a huge task. And does not affect our school. It affects all schools. And I think it's one of those unfortunate regulations that needs to be looked at and changed because it's an unrealistic expectation that someone who has no experience in our system of education, persons who've had little or no formal education, in 1 year would suddenly be at grade level. It's just absurd. At our school, we do not focus on seat time. We focus on achievement. But that regulation makes it very difficult. That's one of our major challenges. The second challenge is that NCLB requirements to hire only highly qualified teachers. We're all in favor of qualified teachers. All of our teachers are licensed and qualified, but it took us 9 years to get there. We saw a lot of wonderful teachers, educators, come but could not stay because they hadn't met the highly qualified standard. We say that the standard should be changed to be highly qualified and effective. Effective teachers are the ones we're seeking. There are many, many, many effective teachers. Some are highly qualified and some are not. Give us a chance to hire effective teachers who have bachelor degrees and then allow us to work with those teachers and put them through a highly qualified program. With that, we can start with people who love children, who care about children, who believe that all children can learn. So that's what those two challenges are, major challenges I think we need to be addressed. The strategies, and there are many, many more, but those are two I would really, really try to focus our attention on. Measures of strategies that have taken to narrow the achievement gap. First, we take a step-by-step approach to this problem of achievement gap. I believe, and our research shows, that the achievement gap, said in other, expressed differently, is the exposure gap. I think Superintendent commented earlier, I believe it was Superintendent's comments, about the lack of language skills that many inner-city children bring to the classroom. Really, as early as kindergarten, that gap is there. I recall that one of the research studies showed that a kindergarten child from an inner city community who was raised in low-income situations where there is limited exposure and opportunity would have roughly a 600-word vocabulary. A child coming from a suburban exposure will come in with the 1,800 or 1,900-word vocabulary. That's kindergarten. The gap is already there. And that gap continues because although we teach and teach and teach, seldom do we really close that gap. And so it's something that must be worked on. And we say we take a step-by-step approach. As I said earlier, all students who enter our school, we give them an assessment using National Norm Reference Test for skills. And then we place students, if they're ELL students, new immigrant students, we place them in a multi-age ELL class that provides intensive English and math instruction. We do not spend a lot of time that early on with science and social studies. Quite honestly, they're great subjects, but if they're not reading and they don't understand the environment, it's not going to be very helpful. So we said, let's focus on the reading and the writing, get that right first. Then we follow that with moving them into bilingual instruction using English augmented by their native ethnic language of the students. That allows a expansion and growth in communication. And then finally, we offer mainstream instruction with our Title I program. So we put the Title I program at the end of that process. And within a year after entering Title I, students primarily can be mainstream. They're not yet grade level yet, but they can be mainstream. For students who are functioning below grade level, who are not new immigrant students, again, we assess and we place based on academic achievement level. We work very, very hard to avoid placing students in special ed initially. One of the regulations would allow that if students 2 or 3 grade levels below, they would qualify for special ed. We think that we must assess more closely because there may not be the type of disability that would necessarily require them to be in special ed, and indeed we find that to be the case. We're putting students directly into our Title I program, and in a year and a half, those students are mainstreamed. Students who cannot be mainstreamed after being in Title I for that period of time, we do then open up a screening and assessment for special ed. We have to be very careful not to place students in special ed because of their academic achievement level, because we have to recognize the exposure that students may or may not have had. The additional measures that we take as a school as a whole for narrowing the achievement gap is we provide a learning year program, a year-round school basically, a learning year program for the students so they get additional 6 weeks of education during the summer. It's not remedial, it's moving ahead with an expectation that these students may graduate early. We essentially, how the funding happens, we're spending down on their 12th year dollars. If they're in the 7th, 8th, or 9th, we're spending down on the 12th years with the expectation that when they get to that point, they're ready for graduation and don't have to spend necessarily that last semester at school. We provide after-school math English classes that are offered after school. We also introduce college teachers into our school because as Dr. Nathan was saying earlier, that we really need to get more of an expanded offering in the schools if possible. And we've attracted college-level teachers to come in and teach so that the remediation does not have to go on in college. That's been very effective. We have instituted a math, language arts, and science computer-based curriculum that's available to all students in the school. It's available also on the internet so the students can access it from home. Gives them multiple chances of continuing to learn. We expect them to complete that curriculum. The sequence, that's a scope of sequence curriculum, we expect them to complete that. And we do that primarily because we want to be sure that students get the exposure to all the learning opportunities. One teacher alone cannot do it all. It takes multiple exposures, and this is an additional exposure that the students would have. We offer study skills for middle school students. It's a course in study skills because we expect students to study. We expect them to have skills, but if we don't teach, how are they going to know? We also teach a course in career exploration to our high school students, recognize that many students just simply don't have the exposure again to all the wonderful opportunities. And once we've learned, once we know what a student wants to do, which is the case anyone, if you know what the student wants to do, now you have a hook, so to speak, into that student. And now the instruction makes sense. Why they take math makes sense if they want to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist or an engineer. It makes sense. They know why they're doing that. So that's another offering we make. Now, concrete results of closing the achievement gap. And you're going to primarily talk numbers here, but try to follow me, please. As we said, although 90% of our students come from low-income families, our school and 85% of New Ingram students, our schools annually make the AYP. We do that because we set high expectations. Students know that. They work for that. Secondly, all Higher Ground Academy graduates, we've had graduates since 2003, all graduates have been accepted into college. We expect that of students. We let them know. They can't get a diploma without presenting us with a letter of acceptance into college, and they know that early on. It's a requirement, and they meet that expectation. In terms of closing the gap, in 2005, the math gap between white students and Higher Ground Academy students was 13 achievement points, while at the same time, the gap between white students and black students as a whole in Minnesota was 26 achievement points based on MCA test results. 2 years later, in 1907, the gap in mathematics between white students and Higher Ground Academy students had narrowed to half, down to 6 achievement points. During the same period, the gap between white students and black students as a whole had widened from 26 to 33 achievement points. So we're closing the gap, and the gap generally is widening for all of the students, particularly students of color or black students. In terms of reading, considering we recognize that we work primarily with new immigrant students, we'd expect their reading levels to be lower. We start with that, and in 2005, the reading gap between white Minnesota students and Higher Ground Academy students was 21 achievement points. By 2007, the gap again had been cut in half, down to 11 achievement points. Meanwhile, the reading gap between white students as a whole and black students had widened from 26 to 29 achievement points, about 7. So we believe that our curriculum is effective, our school is effective, and we demonstrate we're closing this gap. It's about a rigorous curriculum. It's about bringing focus to education. It's about having not only highly qualified but effective teachers. So, Madam Chair and Co-Chair, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wilson, for being here. Sounds like you're doing a remarkable job closing the achievement gap at your school. And maybe I just didn't catch it in the beginning. You were going over some statistics about the amount of staff and some stats at your school. How many students are at your high school?
Roughly 500.
500? Okay. And average class size is about what?
20 to 22.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Hayne.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Wilson. You sound like you have a very interesting school. I'd like to come and visit. Maybe that's something we can arrange to do. I'm very intrigued by the results that you're achieving and interested to know more about that. I take it from your comment about the goal to achieve 1.5 grade level. Is that part of your charter agreement? Is that spelled out in your charter that that's your expectation to make that kind of progress year to year?
It's not in the charter agreement, but it's in the policies we set for our school.
And Madam Chair, and Mr. Wilson, have you been keeping on that pace? Do you feel that as a school that's a goal that is being achieved, that you're seeing that kind of growth? I mean, I know you're not every year because you take in a student that may need to make substantial progress, but is that a goal that you feel that you're largely achieving?
Mr. Wilson.
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator, we are achieving that. And each student, so we're improving, we start where they are and take them where they need to go. And we do move at that rate. It is surprising to me sometimes how much students learn in short periods of time when it's a rigorous curriculum and a focus on education. We have students who come in with older students we put in the multi-age classroom where they're learning from each other and teaching each other. And those students can move two grade levels in a year. Two grade levels. I think part of the problem, with kind of the seat time strategy we have for moving children ahead, doesn't really tie down to what children can do. They're much brighter than that. They have much more potential than that. And I think if we challenge them more, they'll give us more. I think oftentimes the curriculum in schools that are rich in size and rich in dollars, sometimes the curriculum is extremely redundant rather than to teach with a focus on what the child, that moves the child through a scoping sequence. Oftentimes they're taking courses that are irrelevant oftentimes to achieving higher standards. But we are meeting that, yes.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, one last question. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Dr. Nathan presented us with some data on some of the differences between larger schools and smaller schools in terms of just the kinds of behaviors or the negative behaviors that sometimes accrue in larger schools that don't seem to be happening in smaller schools. Can you make any comment about that factor in your school? I guess related to that, do you require uniforms or do you have other kinds of behavioral expectations that are different than, say, a traditional public school?
Well, we are very comfortable with the smaller school. We think that works better. We know it does. Since we started out as a uniform school, it took us about 3 years to figure out that we're spending more time trying to keep kids in uniform than we're teaching them. Mm-hmm. And so we said, it's not about what you have on, it's what you have in you. And so we started focusing on that aspect of it. Many of our students are East African students, as I said, and many of them are Muslim students. So they come, the girls in particular, come in uniform. So that takes care of half the problem right off. But we do have a sense of community, a connectiveness between students. We think it's important to work real hard to know each student by their first name, at least their first name, and they to know us. That is a very important. I was going to give you an example. A child who missed their bus and where they ran in my office and hid on the desk. They felt safe there, and usually that's just the opposite of what you'd expect of an administrator. But that's the sense of community that we have and a connectiveness. And with parents, we invite parents. We get them involved in the school. We could say a lot about that, but, yes, we're very comfortable with that. We don't intend to outgrow that 500. We want to keep it small.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, I have a question. Senator Erickson-Rose.
Well, you can go ahead if you want. I'll follow you.
I wanted to ask you a question about some kind of finger-pointing that goes on with respect to the education of low-income children, and that is that there is a tendency, I think, or at least an argument as to who's responsible for the education of the children or what are the expectations. So some argue that we really need to pay attention to kind of the social conditions, the home environment, in order to really look at academic achievement. And others argue that it is our obligation to have schools that really prepare our children and that all children can learn regardless of their class and their social background. I would like to hear what are your thoughts with respect to these two arguments that are presented often when we talk about, you know, who's responsible for the academic achievement of low-income children of color?
Well, Madam Chair, it's an excellent question. placed simply, I think the informal education is a responsibility of the family, and the formal education is a responsibility of school. And oftentimes, we remind our teachers that when children come to us, they come to us speaking a language, they come to us walking. Two very difficult tasks to achieve. But they've learned a lot, and nobody taught them that. They learned it. They learned it through imitation. And if teachers model for them properly with instruction, they also will learn those other things too. But the parents have prepared them that far. I'm reminded that the majority of the parents who are low income today went through an education system somewhere, in particular, maybe in this country, maybe abroad, elsewhere. But the fact is they went through a system that probably did not serve them very well. So we cannot hold them responsible for the education of the formal education of the child if they themselves have not been educated. But what we do hold them to is being supportive of education and providing a child with the incentive to learn and recognize this child gets one chance to get an education. That's when they're a child. When they're beyond that, it's not going to be there. So if they're going to help, they got to help in that way. So it's not about blaming the family, the conditions. We have an education system that recognizes those conditions are there. What can we do about it to change it? And that's where we come to the point of the exposure gap. How do we expose children to situations that allow them to learn, to grow, and to not want to be forever in a low-income situation? So it elevates their expectations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Wilson. I want to hear what you have to say about a rather thorny subject that comes up quite often. You have mentioned that you have students that are immigrants or children of immigrants, and there's a lot of folks who get very angry when they find out that there are foreign-speaking teachers in Minnesota schools that are teaching a foreign language or working with children who speak another language to learn English. And they also get very angry when they think of undocumented status and the children of parents who may have undocumented status. So can you explain, since you have the mic in the ear of Minnesota right now, what the effects would be if we did not educate children, no matter their immigrant status?
Madam Chair, I think that's a very, very important question. The United States is a country of immigrants. We might have all come from different places, but we're all in the same place. Before the public education system was established, you're essentially describing what it would be like if we didn't have it. Children were living on the streets with little opportunity. Parents were off working, trying to make a living, leaving children behind. There was nothing except for wealthy children in form of an education. Recent studies have shown that if Minnesota does not educate all of its people, we're going to lose what advantages we have because with retirement facing many of the baby boomers, there's this group of children who are coming along needing the education, particularly the technical skills and the higher education skills to be able to step into this economy that Minnesota flourishes in, the high-tech economy. If we can't meet that, then we're all going to suffer. Regardless of where the child is from, he's here now. And we have to pay attention to that and pay more attention to educating that child rather than trying to document that child. That's my impression. I think I think it's where we need to be. I think it's Minnesota, that's where we need to be.
And Dr. Wilson, do you think that children, if they were not educated and marginalized, because they're here because of their family status, would be more subject to winding up in jail or some sort of impoverished futures? It seems to me the future would be pretty bleak for kids if they can't get through school.
Absolutely. As I said, education is the tool by which people are going to be able to advance themselves. With skills and knowledge, they'll be able to sustain themselves, be able to not exist but develop into the future. Without that, it would be very, very, very bleak. There was a study, it's called the school-to-prison pipeline, that was done some time ago, and the research shows that people who plan prisons plan it based on the reading scores and levels of children in the third grade. Use that. And it was practiced here in Minnesota for a while, but it's a nationally recognized study, very, very, very telling of the relationship to education and future. Without the education, and I must quickly say, some time ago in an earlier life, I worked at the University of Minnesota, and one of the projects I did at that time was to go into prisons and work with inmates. And the thing that caught my attention about the work I was doing with the inmates is that the vast majority of them could not read, and it ties directly down to what this study is saying. So it's children who are unable to read, those are the most vulnerable children, those are the children who cannot decipher and decode what's going on around them, but somebody tells them, and they become followers. And unfortunately, there's little future for adults who come through that, come to adulthood without an education. It's very, very important.
Thank you, Doctor.
Senator? Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. We really appreciate your testimony, and we will continue to be in touch. And we are really impressed with the work that you're doing, and we hope that as we move forward in trying to think about how we frame our legislation, you could advise us on that effort.
I'd appreciate it.
Based on your experience. Thank you. Members of the committee, thank you, and we will continue the conversations. And for now, this meeting is adjourned.